Amen. Thank you, Gene. So we say this a lot at Veritas, that if you're new to Veritas, you love Veritas Church, just give us time, right? And we'll disappoint you. And usually it's one of two things that disappoints you. Number one, it might be you start to realize that we are sinners just like you, right? I'm no different than you, struggle with all the same things, and maybe you get in my connection group and you're like, man, it's worse than I thought, you know? And, you know, or it may, and you know, there's this saying that the church is filled with sinners, but there's no other place to be a Christian, right? So welcome to Veritas, come as you are, all that. But the second thing I've noticed is that people often will leave Veritas once they find out we teach through the Bible and are confronted with passages that sort of confront the American worldview and the things that our culture values. And so this is one of those passages that may thin out the crowds a little bit next week, all right? So we're committed to just opening God's Word and trying to teach it as it is. So that's the challenge that I have this morning. Now, there's three goals that I have as we jump in. Number one, I want us to zoom out, and I want us to see this passage in its context. So we're going to zoom out, we're going to see context, where Peter, the logical thought progression that has brought us to this point. Number two, I want to zoom in, and I want us to understand the text itself, the particulars of what Peter is saying. And number three, I want all of us to leave filled with hope. Okay, so that's where we're going. He begins with this word, likewise. So following this progression of thought, starting in chapter 1, he begins addressing his letter. It's a letter to the churches in first century, what is modern-day Turkey. He says, to God's elect, exiles scattered, chosen to be obedient to Jesus Christ. He's saying, Christians, this is not our home. And he continues that thought in verse 13. He says, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. He says, we are strangers in this world. We are exiles in this world, but we are people of hope. We are marked by hope because we've got a living hope kept in heaven for us. It's imperishable. It's unfading. And then this hope gets real practical, okay? This is what we talked about last week. Chapter 2, verse 13, he says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Context, number one, first thing, write this down if you're taking notes. If Jesus is Lord, you are free to submit to authority. If Jesus is Lord, you are free to submit to authority. The reason that we can submit to suffering, we talked about this last week, is we as Christians, we know who we are and we know whose we are. We know that we are God's chosen people. We are royalty. And we know whose we are, that we belong to Him, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So suffering, as one commentator says, it's our calling, not our fate. It is our calling, not our fate. It's not random forces of nature that have put us in this country, in this job, in this family, in this marriage, at this time. This is a calling from God. And you know, the root word of authority is what? Author. We know who wrote the story, and we know how it ends. Okay, so that is the Christian worldview as it relates to submitting to authority. And I think what Peter is saying to us as Christians, you don't need to fight for privilege because you are already privileged beyond your wildest dreams. So all of this grabbing for power, you know how the world does it, right? Everyone's trying to get to the top. He says, let it go and receive what God is going to do in your life and how he's going to use your even authority and even suffering to glorify him. So last week, verse 21 said, "For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you might follow in his steps." We talked about how this Greek word for the leaving you an example is literally, he's left you the writing under. What does that mean? Well, this is how they would teach kids the Greek alphabet. They would give them a copy, and the kids would put their paper over the top, and they would just trace it. And what he's saying is, Jesus has left you the pattern to trace over. So just put your life over the top of Jesus' life and just start tracing. So the second context here is that Jesus is the pattern to trace your life over. Jesus is the pattern to trace your life over. Okay, here's the pattern. Matthew chapter 16, verse 21. We see a clear picture of two patterns. The world's pattern and Jesus' pattern. It says this, "From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised." Imagine this. Imagine being a part of this conversation. Jesus pulls in his disciples like, "All right, guys, here's the game plan. We're going into Jerusalem, and here's what we're going to do. You know all those guys that you hate, the religious leaders? Okay, you know Rome, Pontius Pilate, hate Rome, hate these religious leaders, and here's what we're going to do. Here's our strategy. I'm going to go in, I'm going to suffer a gruesome death, and I'm going to die in Jerusalem." And Peter says these words, verse 22, "Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you.' But he turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man.'" Do you see that? Two patterns. We've got Peter with this worldly mentality. And the culture, our culture, is like Peter, very confused, because we think that it's impossible for suffering to be God's plan. I mean, it makes sense, right? If you're a king, kings don't suffer. They rule with iron scepters, right? With a crown on their head. This can't be the plan. This can't be the way it's supposed to go down. And Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." That worldview is satanic, because what I'm about to do is submit myself to a cross. "Peter, put away your sword." And as Jesus hung on the cross, it says the crowds mocked him. You know, I'm sure they were thinking, if he was truly God, there's no way it would end this way. And thankfully, Jesus had in mind the things of God and not the things of man, because he knew that there had to be a death to bring about a resurrection. And so we see that Jesus' pattern of suffering is the example for us to follow. The third point, by way of context, is historical context. And here's the point. As a woman in ancient Rome, choosing hope was a risk. Let me set up the cultural context that Peter's writing into. I want you to imagine for a moment being a woman in Rome and the risk you would take, the vulnerable position you would put yourself in if you became a follower of Jesus. So as a girl, you probably would have played with dolls. And as a girl, it was tradition that you would dedicate your dolls to Diana. She was the goddess of girlhood. Or maybe as you approached marriage, you would dedicate yourself, these dolls, your life to Venus, the goddess of marriage. And so, as an adult, you would be expected to, as you're getting into your teen years, you would be expected as a woman to get married and to begin having children. And you would be expected to take on the gods of your husband. And so now, as a follower of Jesus, you would be going against the whole Roman society. It's you versus the culture. And we know that this about Rome, maybe you've read about the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, that they valued social order and keeping people in line. And so here you stand, going against the culture, disrupting this social order, and not to mention the criticism you would face from your now unbelieving husband. A whole value system that's different. Imagine that conversation. As a woman in Rome, you probably, unless you are a woman of elite status and privilege, you probably would not have had friends outside of your home and your family. And so now you're talking to your husband about, hey, I'm going to connection group tonight. Wait, what? Imagine the conversation about, hey, I've been reading the Bible and it talks about giving. What would you think about giving part of our income to my church? And what? Imagine the shame that would even come upon your husband as now your conversion hurts his status in society. So this woman, by becoming a follower of Jesus, has put herself at risk in a vulnerable situation. And so it's into this context that Peter writes these words, chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. What's interesting here is that slaves and wives weren't even addressed by the philosophers and writers of the day. And so Peter, by addressing them, acknowledges that they are not, as the culture says, subhuman or inferior. He's addressing them as equals. Their culture, like ours, had a distorted value system. Your value was associated with your position and how powerful your position was. So we do the same thing in our culture. Like, think about this. What gives someone value in our culture? A position of power. Maybe you're a politician. Maybe you're a CEO or a boss. Or maybe you are a lawyer or a surgeon. Some type of executive. But it's into that twisted culture and distorted value system that Peter affirms the value and the dignity of women as equals to men. In verse 7 of chapter 3, he says that women are joint heirs of the grace of life. So do you see what Peter's doing? He's, even as he's addressing slaves, as he's addressing servants, he's attributing to them equal status before God. And so the point we want to make here as we look at the particular of this text, as we zoom in, is we want to make this statement: your position does not determine your value. God does. Your position does not determine your value. God does. Okay, so moving on, he says at the end of verse 1, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Peter, he says this statement, as they see your pure conduct in fear. What does he mean there? Well, he's not talking about the fear of the husband. He's not talking about the fear of society. He's talking about the fear that this woman has is a fear of God. He uses the same motivation for submission to the servants in chapter 2, verse 18, when he says, submit to them in reverent fear of God. So listen, this is so important because the motive for submission is no longer societal norms. He's not telling women to submit because they're inferior. He's telling women to submit because they're God's elect. This woman commentator, Karen Jobes, says this about this passage. She says, quote, in a masterful move, Peter both upholds and subverts the social order. Because he's saying you're free, you're chosen, you're loved, so therefore you submit. Not you're inferior, culture says, you're subhuman, therefore submit. So he turns this whole thing upside down. And he says there, even if they, in verse 1, he says, even if some do not obey the word, in the original language, this is like a present active tense. Like these husbands are actively rebelling against God. They're actively going against the scriptures. Now, there's a lie that I think our culture believes and assumes is true. Tell me if you've experienced this. I think culture says you should only submit to good authority. Do you think that's accurate? The culture pretty much assumes that if the authority is not good, you should not submit to it. If your boss has unreasonable expectations, if your president doesn't have great moral character, if you're in a situation or circumstance where the authority is not good, you don't have a responsibility to submit. But Christianity, of course, turns this whole thing upside down because when Jesus submitted to the cross, he submitted him to religious hypocrites and Roman pagan rulers. But here's what's interesting, and I think Peter would say, Jesus wasn't submitting to these men. He was submitting to God. Jesus, when he submitted to the cross, wasn't submitting to Pilate. He was submitting to his Father in heaven. In all of these examples that Peter gives of submission, he makes it clear that the motivation for submission is distinctly Christian. If you're here this morning and you don't claim to be a follower of Jesus, I don't expect this to make any sense to you, right? Because if, think about it, in a world without God, it kind of makes sense, right? Like, why would I submit to an authority that I disagree with? Like, I have rights, and I have a right to demand those rights. But Peter's saying, our motivation for submission is directly connected to the fact that we know who our ultimate authority is, and our motive is our reverence for God. That's what he says in verse 2. But he gives another reason for why we should submit. And he says this because these unbelieving husbands might be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. Unbelievers need Jesus. And when we model submission, we model the gospel. People will get saved if we can follow Jesus' example. This is a powerful statement that Peter says, that you could win someone to Jesus Christ without saying a word. That is amazing because they see a personal presentation of Jesus Christ when you endure a difficult marriage, a difficult boss, a difficult circumstance. So our second point, as we zoom into this text, we see that a difficult marriage is an opportunity to preach the gospel without words. Peter's saying, don't leave your unbelieving husband. Endure the hard marriage because you become a personal presentation of Jesus to them. You know, I think this principle applies not just to wives who are married, women who are married to unbelievers. Last week, I heard the story of this young woman who just graduated from the University of Iowa. She was a part of Salt Company. Actually, some girls had been reaching out to her and praying for her. And just before she graduated and left Iowa City, she gave her life to Jesus. And she had been fearing this decision and because she knew what her family would think. And so just a few weeks ago, she told her parents what she had done. Her parents had come out to visit her for the weekend. And when she told them the news that she had given her life to Jesus, they were supposed to stay the whole weekend, and they basically left that night. And they called her and they said, you're going to have to pay us back for all your college tuition. We're cutting you off our insurance. You are on your own now. And as Shannon, our SALT coordinator, was telling the story, she said, and you wouldn't believe her response. Even as she's telling the story, she's trying to honor her parents and love them. Even in that situation where evil is being done against her, she is still trying to honor them as her parents. This principle is not just for wives. I think all of us can take something out of it. Let me just say a few things about a few disclaimers here, because I think this is important. I don't want you to get the wrong idea in these few areas. Number one, if you're in a marriage and your husband is asking you to sin against God, don't do it, okay? I don't think Peter, I mean, we see even in Peter's own life examples of his own disobedience to the law of Rome and Jewish laws. So I would encourage you not to sin if your husband is asking you to. The second disclaimer is, if your husband is physically abusing you, I want to encourage you, please, I want to beg with you, please tell someone, get help. You can talk to me, right? I mean, you can talk to someone that you've seen up on stage. You can talk to our elders or find someone that you know is connected to Veritas Church, and please share your story. My neighbor is the head of the domestic violence here in the Johnson County, and we can get you help. Okay, there's help for you. So please, if you are experiencing domestic violence, please talk to someone about it. The third thing I want to say about this is that Peter is talking in a very specific context. This is the context of marriage. So this is a submission of a wife to a husband, not to all men, okay? This is important. It's between a husband and wife what submission looks like in the marriage. Okay, that's not for me to determine. That's not for anyone else to determine. If the wife is better at finances, you guys decide, you know, who does the bills, right? If the wife is more outgoing and more articulate or a better driver, then she drives the car. She, you know, is the life of the party. All those things, like what that looks like in a marriage is between a husband and a wife, okay? So understand the context. Also, in terms of our society, I don't think Peter's saying a woman can't be a CEO or can't be a president or can't be whatever, okay? She might be smarter, she might be more dynamic socially, she might be a better teacher, a better leader, all those things in society. I think Peter is speaking specifically to marriage. Okay, verse 3. He says, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear. So now he moves on to modesty. Now there are two extremes when we come to the conversation of modesty. Extreme number one on the right is legalism related to what you can wear and what you can't wear. That's bad, okay? The rule book, like don't wear this, don't wear this, that's bad, okay? Over here, we've got the kind of other extreme related to modesty, which is all of that's cultural. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't apply. So just kind of wear whatever you want. Okay, both extremes I think we want to avoid here. So what is he talking about? Okay, he says, don't braid your hair or wear gold. I don't think he's literally saying braiding your hair is sin. Some of you are like, oh no, I braided my hair this morning. It looks great, okay? I'm just saying, Peter's not talking about specifically you can't braid your hair, you can't wear gold. Because in Greek, the literal translation is, he says, let not your adorning be the putting on of clothing. All right, now if we're to take this literal, he's saying women shouldn't wear clothes. Okay, that's clearly not what he's prescribing for us in the church. Now, I don't think he's telling women to be unfashionable. We see in Proverbs 31 that this woman who fears God is dressed in fine linen and purple. So here's his point. Listen to this. Every ad, every commercial, every movie, every magazine cover is screaming something at you, women. And what it's telling you is that your worth is in your beauty. Your value is how beautiful you are, how much you can maintain your youth as you age and avoid wrinkles and gray hair, all of those things. And that's what your value is in society. And Peter is saying, no, no. Your outward appearance does not define your worth. That's a third point. Your outward appearance does not define your worth. But here's what I think he would say about clothing. What you wear says something about what you believe. Your clothes communicate something. And if you're dressing immodestly, you might be communicating, I want to be noticed, I want to be loved, I want to be valued, because that's what culture tells me is valuable, so I want to be valuable. Peter says no. Your value comes from verse 4. He says, let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. And if we see the context here, I think he's saying to this wife who's married to an unbeliever that even if your unbelieving husband has put value on your outward appearance, understand what God finds valuable. Remember what gives you value. He says this hidden person of the heart with imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. He says gentle and quiet spirit. Now, I want to say that these virtues are not distinctly feminine qualities. This is not connected to a personality type. You're like, some of you women are like, I'm bold, I'm outgoing, I'm a fierce competitor. Peter is not asking you to get a different personality. Here's why we know that. Because in Matthew 11, these are the words that Jesus used to describe himself. He said, I'm gentle and humble in heart. Matthew 21 says this, as Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, it says he rode in, what? Gentle and riding on a donkey. Same words. And finally, Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4:11, to all Christians, he says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. He's not saying, women, don't be outgoing in the life of the party. He's saying, be gentle. Don't be pushy. Don't be demanding your own way. Don't force your faith on your husband. That's not the best strategy. The virtue here is that you have this quiet confidence, this fierce confidence. that God is in control and you can trust his plan. Now, let me ask you some questions by way of application here. Number one, what does your wardrobe say about where you're finding your worth? If we're just to look in your closet, what would your wardrobe say about where you find worth? Is your wardrobe unreasonably expensive? If we go through all of your accessories and your clothes, would we find it to be embarrassingly expensive? I think Peter's warning us about that when he talks about wearing gold, you know. Is your wardrobe immodest? How about this one? What does your Snapchat or Instagram feed or Facebook say about what you believe? What do the clothes that you're wearing, what does your appearance communicate about what you value? This one, I think, hits hard too. Are you putting as much time into your soul as you are your body? I mean, this body, it's a tent. Like, it's going to age, it's going to wrinkle, it's going to be gone, right? But Peter says there is an imperishable beauty that comes from your character. I love this. Dallas Willard says, "You are now becoming the person you forever will be. Your character will go with you into heaven forever." Your character will matter forever. Are you investing as much in your character as you are your outward appearance? Let me just say something to the men in the room, because this week I was horrified and burdened by some of the stories that came out with the hashtag MeToo movement within just a few hours. This went viral, and as women began to share their stories of sexual harassment or sexual assault, and a big light is being shined on this problem in our culture of how men view and treat women. And what I want to say is, men in our culture are going to do what men do, okay? And I hope that changes. But I want to speak to the men in this room. Men, do you value what God values? Do your actions, what you choose to look at, the way you talk about women, does it say that you value what God values? Or does it just exacerbate the problem and make the women feel like their value comes from how they look? I want to encourage you to think about what the implications of this are for you. Because, and to the single men, you're not going to marry a body. You're going to marry a person who is loved and is precious to God. And if what you're filling your mind with is just continuing this systemic evil that we've heard through the hashtag MeToo stories, you need to rethink what you're choosing to fill your mind and your heart with and change your perspective. Okay, so it ends in verse 5. He says, "For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by submitting to their own husbands as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him her Lord." Calling him Lord. And that would be a polite way of addressing him, like Mr., using a title of honor. He says, "And you're her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening." Verse 5, he talks about the holy women. This would be the women like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah. And if you go back and read those stories of their husbands, Have you ever read their stories? Like, these men are messed up. These men are not godly, spiritual leaders in the home, protecting their families, providing for these families. I mean, these men are broken, right? These men are not perfect leaders, and yet the example is of Sarah. She hoped in God. Her hope was not in Abraham's the man, he's going to lead us home, right? No, her hope was in God. And she did not fear anything that was frightening. And you know, I tend to agree with Jen Wilkin on this point. If you haven't listened to Jen Wilkin's message, her teaching on 1 Peter 3, like, you should listen to it. It's gold. But I agree with her on this point. I think you kind of ask the question, what was it in Sarah's life that what was the circumstance in which she submitted to Abraham? And I think it's the story of Isaac. Remember this, in their old age, they had a son, Isaac. And in, I think it's Genesis 22, God says, Abraham, I want your son. Abraham goes to Sarah, and we don't see much of the conversation, but imagine Sarah handing off her son, Isaac, her only son. Imagine how frightening that would be, how terrifying that would be as a mom to let go of her child as her husband would walk Isaac up the mountain to offer to God. And this is the picture of hope. Hebrews 11 says that Abraham was hoping in the resurrection. And I believe that Sarah's hope was no different as she let him go, that she was hoping in God. Her hope was set fully on the grace to be given her, as Peter says. And sometimes our hope and our submission includes tears. And in the case of Jesus in Gethsemane, it was tears of blood as he wept and he cried out to God and he said, if there's any other way. As he offered himself. Sometimes that's what hope looks like. Peter says, set your hope fully on the grace to be given when Jesus is revealed. I just want to end with this story. And it happened a couple weeks ago. I was up in Minneapolis speaking to Salt City Church. And I reconnected with a friend, Henry Elgersma. And Henry's actually the architect that's designing our building. Cool story. But I was talking to Henry, and his mom happened to be up there visiting church that week. And I wanted to meet her because I knew Henry's story. When Henry was 12, his dad came down with, I believe, cancer. And things were getting worse. The cancer was taking over his body. And I was asking Henry's mom to tell me the story, to color it in a little bit, and she was saying, yeah, it was a few months before my husband passed away that I was talking to my parents, and they were saying, you know, we're going to plan to move to your town so that we can help you raise your children. I think it was four or five children that she had. We're going to come and help you. And it was a couple weeks before her husband died that both her parents were killed in a car accident. And then she loses her husband. And she said, I was standing by my dresser in my room after I lost my parents, lost my husband. And I'm in a house with these four kids. And Jesus spoke to me. And he said, I am your husband. And she said, and all these years, he has been the best husband to me. I wonder this morning if there are some women in this room that came in feeling hopeless. because you're in a difficult marriage. Maybe your husband doesn't know Jesus. Or maybe your husband does know Jesus, but he's not a spiritual leader. Maybe you feel like you're pulling him along and he just won't lead. And this morning you just feel more than disappointment. Maybe you feel despair. Maybe you're even thinking about divorce. I would invite you to set your hope on that day when Jesus will reveal himself and you will see your husband for the first time. And it will make all of your endurance and suffering worth it. Let's close in prayer and communion. And actually, I'm going to invite the worship team and Rebecca up. I've asked Rebecca Johnson. She's our women's ministry coordinator. And just asked her to pray over the women in this room, to pray over all of us, and to lead us into a time of communion.
Let's pray. Father in heaven, I pray this morning over this congregation that we would be filled with hope. I pray that your goodness would inspire us to lay down our rights. God, draw our minds and hearts to the example of Jesus and teach us to submit like him. Teach us to trust you as both loving Father and just judge. But Father, I specifically pray over every woman in this room that from the deepest parts of our hearts, hope would arise. From the hearts that are raw, wounded, bitter, and very tired, that even from these hearts would come belief. God, I specifically pray for the woman who feels very alone this morning. Women who feel alone in their marriage, desiring heart change for their husbands. I pray for the women who are struggling with bitterness towards their husbands. May your nearness and your love rush over them today, refreshing them and reminding them that you, God, see them in their situation. Invite them to know your love and your care this morning. Show them how they can labor as unto you. Invite these women to hope. For the women out here who have seen submission go wrong and look nothing like you designed it, please bring comfort. By the power of your word, reveal to them a new definition of submission. For the woman who feels skeptical or even offended by the scripture, please invite them to hope as well. Invite them to hope in the God of the Bible and to understand anew how loved they are. Draw them to the truth that nothing in your word is intended for our harm, nothing. I pray for the women like me who forget that it's not my words or appearance that promote change, but it's a heart that depends fully on you. It's not our agendas and it's not our white-knuckled control that will bring the change in people around us, but it is our examples, our godly behavior fueled by your spirit. So God, create within us brave and trusting hearts. We want to be women who are fearless, women who fend off fear with faith in a good God. Let that faith reassure us that your design can be embraced and that from a place of submission, we can be mountain movers. We can become great advocates and women of influence. Lord, it is that kind of faith that creates true beauty. And so invite us today to identify our fears, move powerfully in our souls, to know that you are benevolent, you are trustworthy, you are faithful, and therefore help us to not fear anything that is frightening. God, help us see that when we are hoping in you, and overcoming our fears, we can find submission to be a joy. We believe that your love for us is equal to the men, and we want to embrace our wonderfully unique roles, and we want to delight to live according to your design. So God, our hope is in you. It is sure and it is steady. It is a hope that allows us to be long-suffering, a hope that equips us to persevere and to put ourselves under your mighty arm. May we be adorned with hope like the women who went before us. May we be women who cling to an eternal promise, who cling to an ancient text, and to a God of rich mercy. We thank you for your love. Amen.